Hi, I'm Tara, and welcome to Let's Do Books. I'm excited, friends, because this week, Lynn Ames is back. Lynn is the author of 16 lesbian books, and because she is not content with sticking with one genre, they span the range of romance, romantic comedy, romantic intrigue, and historical fiction. The latest is 46, and it is out everywhere. Welcome, Lynn.
Hey, thank you, Tara. Thanks for having me back. I love to be here with you.
So you are here today to talk about fiction that centers on politics. You both write it and you read it. So I was wondering if you could start by sharing why it's important that we reflect the politics of the day in our fiction.
Sure. First of all, I not only write it and read it, but it was my profession for a long time. Politics has always played a role in my life. I began my career as a broadcast journalist, and then I went into politics and government in New York State. I was the press secretary to the Senate Minority Leader in New York State, and then the spokesperson for the state prison system, which is the third largest in the nation. I helped with the original Governor Cuomo, Mario Cuomo's reelection campaigns. So it's in my blood. And I think that it is critical that our books reflect the times in which we live. We are, in essence, chronicling our times for those who will come after us. And in order to do that, you have to give context and an accurate picture. And particularly where minority groups are concerned, like lesbians, the LGBTQIA plus community, we have to talk about those issues and how they impact us so that not only are we giving people an accurate reflection of the current times, but going forward, historically speaking, people will be able to look back and judge the times based on the work that we're doing. You have to leave a record. You have to leave a footprint. So not only is it satisfying, I think, for audiences who have lived through it, but it will be satisfying, I hope, in years to come for audiences down the road. You hope that the fiction holds up long term. And politics, like it or not like it, is a big part of our life. You know, government and politics, as we know right now in the middle of the pandemic, is paramount to our daily lives. It affects us in ways both large and small. And so I think that to that extent, people who write political fiction or political intrigue or political romance, we're reflecting the world in which we live. You know, well, I'm sure that you're going to get into in a little while how much of our world are we ready to listen to and to talk about in present times. How fresh is it and how good is that? And so that's something I'm sure we're going to address. But in any event, I think it's very important for us to chronicle the times in which we live. We are essentially historians, and recording it in real time makes a difference.
And your books don't all address it the same way. Like in some, the politics are very much at the forefront, and in others, it's almost more like the wallpaper of the story, I guess. So how do you go about deciding your approach?
You know, every book that I write starts with a single question, and the single question is, what if? What if something happened just a little bit differently than it really did? What if they had made a different choice here? What would that look like? And sometimes that's about the wallpaper, and sometimes that's the front and centerpiece of your living room, you know. And particularly depending upon what's going on in any given place in history. I'll give you a couple of quick for instances, just so that I can sort of place this for you. My new book, 46. Is very front and center political. Obviously, it's about the next president of the United States. It starts on election night 2020, you know, November 2020, just months from now. That's front and center. And that piece of the book, it's just a very political book, is right in front of your face. There are other books where it takes less of a role, but like, for instance, I wrote a book called The Value of Valor. And in The Value of Valor, what I did was Google the year 1989. And if you Google the year 1989, a very interesting thing happens. Now everybody's running to go Google 1989. If you Google the year 1989, one of the most interesting things that I found was this whole series of coincidences, in quotation marks, that could not possibly have been coincidental. And I started thinking, well, what if they weren't coincidental? In 1989, all of those communist countries fell one block at a time. You know, the Soviet, all of this stuff started coming apart. Tiananmen Square in China and Poland. And then there was Russia and Gorbachev. And all of this stuff happened in a short period of time over a series of months. And I started asking myself the question, what if those weren't really coincidences that they happened that close together? What if there was some shadowy group responsible for all of it? And so it made me start to look into that. And that became the backdrop for a story of intrigue around some group. So that's a little bit more wallpaper than it was front and center. You know, I've written historical fiction like Secrets Well Kept, which is about the women who created the fuel for the atomic bomb, and they really did, in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. So politics, the government, was the backdrop for this very personal story about these women who didn't know what they were creating until the bomb got dropped and it was, and Harry Truman announced on the radio that they were the ones who had made the fuel. How would you feel about that? So that was a very personal story, but it had a very big governmental political backdrop to it. It just depends on how personal you want the story to be and what your message is. And every book, I think, that involves intrigue, politics, something like that, most of them have a message in them. And what's your takeaway? What's the message here that you're trying to send? What are you telling people about the time? And sometimes that needs to be front and center, and sometimes having it be wallpaper is just fine.
Secrets Well Kept is my favorite.
Oh, I'm so glad you love it.
Yeah, I love
that one. Me too. I love it. It was the hardest book to research, honestly, because it was a secret place. So there wasn't much that existed about it. And find to recreate what really happened there was a challenge. But I had a lot of help from a lot of experts, including one of the women who was one of the people who created the fuel. She was fascinating and wonderful and marvelous. And what a find she was.
All right. We're going to take a little tangent because I have to know. And before we started recording this, you were talking about the people you interviewed for 46. I'm like, how do you get access to the people that you get access to? Is it because of your past life in reporting, or like, just how did you find a woman who worked in the factory and get her to talk to you?
Well, you know what? I mean, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. And sometimes it's better to be good than lucky. I collect people, like some people collect trading cards, you know, so I find someone who has an interesting background and I hold on to that piece of information. And also it is my reporting background. You know, there is no source that is better than an original source. Someone, you know, first person source means in the reporting world, someone who was there, someone who knows. It's like with Eyes on the Stars, I wrote this book about the women Air Force service pilots. I met four of them who flew those planes. Now, I got lucky there. It turned out that there was a World War II airplane hangar not 5 minutes from my house when I was living in Phoenix, Arizona. I didn't even know it was there. And they happened to be coming for a Remembrance Day on Veterans Day. So I saw the announcement that day, and I went over to meet them and interview them. That was lucky. Sometimes you just get lucky, and maybe the universe helps you out. Who knows what that is? But so sometimes it happens that way. One time I sat down and I was sitting at a lunch counter having brunch. You know, you remember when we could do that?
Feels like 100 years ago.
I know, it does. Well, I sat down next to this lovely older couple and I'm listening to them chat, and they were really great people. And it turns out that she was an engineer for Boeing or something like that. And I had some work that I was working on that involved airplane technology and so forth. And I just, you know, I said to her, would you mind if I kept in touch with you? Would you, you know, can I use you as a source? I sat down on a plane one time next to a guy who turned out to be an FBI special agent in charge of something I was investigating for a book. I mean, sometimes you just get really lucky, and then sometimes it is who you know.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, for 46, a good friend of mine from college, and this will seem odd to you, but there was a good friend of mine from college. He was a Democrat at the time, who became ultimately George W. Bush's, George W. Bush, not mm-hmm. the senior, but the shrub, as I call him. Because he's too small to be a Bush. He became his press secretary. So for 46, I had access to the press secretary to the President of the United States to make sure that I got the protocol correct for anything I talked about that had to do with the president. So if I interviewed, his name is Ari Fleischer, I interviewed him twice, and I sent him emails periodically if I have a question. Like I came to a question in the middle of 46. The president was going to get called in the middle of the night about an emergency. And I started thinking to myself, well, who makes that? Who's the unlucky guy who draws, or woman who draws the straw mm-hmm. that has to make that phone call to the president? And I didn't know for sure who it was. So I emailed Ari and I said, can you tell me who would call the president in this situation? And he came back to me with the answer. He said it would either be the National Security Advisor or it would be the chief of staff who would make that phone call. And I said, and who would be in the room with the president in the Situation Room to discuss whatever happened after that? And he told me all of the positions that would be there. So this is how I know things are accurate mm-hmm. in my work. First-person sources make all the difference. So sometimes I get lucky, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's somebody I know. For 46, there are three Army generals who reviewed this book with me. One of them is a woman who actually, after her time in the military, became Boeing's, the first female test pilot for Boeing. First one in their history. This woman flew everything, and she taught me virtually over the phone how to fly a Black Hawk helicopter. So that there's a scene in the book where my main character, Palmer Estes, is the second main character, who's a four-star general, which is the highest ranking woman in the Army, she's back in Desert Storm, and she flies a Sikorsky Black Hawk helicopter. And so I knew how to do it, you know, so I had her fly it. And I sent the scene to Rose, and I said, please tell me anything I got wrong. Please tell me what I need to do here. And she came back and she said, my heart's pounding. This is great. Where's the rest of the book? I'm like,
wonderful.
Okay, I'll send you the rest of the book. So her I met through a contact. And I met another general through a contact, who is Tammy Smith, who actually blurbed the book for me and read every chapter with me as we went along. And she is the highest ranking lesbian in the Army. She's a two-star general. She was the first gay or lesbian to come out after Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the mm-hmm. Army. She got married to her wife by an Army chaplain. You know, I mean, fabulous story. So mm-hmm. Tammy went through all of it with me. And I met her again through another source who I actually know in person, who was a brigadier general who was a two-time Purple Heart winner. You know, so sometimes it's who you know. Sometimes you sit next to the right person. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's who you get introduced to through other people. It's a combination of things. But truly, if you want to write fiction, the best way to write fiction is to have elements of truth in it. The most truth you can put in it makes for the best fiction. Because I think what I find is that if you write something without having done that kind of research, you'll find that someone out there knows the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it will take your book out of integrity if it doesn't match what is true. I mean, think about lawyers who watch Law and Order and things like that. They want to throw something at the television set, or the yeah. all those medical shows where, you know, they leave their clamp in or something like that. And you're going, yeah, that would never happen. No, no. Mm-hmm. First person source is always the best.
So can you share some of the political fiction that you've enjoyed that other people have written, and why you've enjoyed it so much?
You bet. You know, I love, I'm a junkie in terms of reading that kind of stuff. I mean, I love to read what other people are working on, what other people think. I don't often get a lot of time to read. You know, one of the things is, as you become an author, you become an author because you love to read. because you love books and you love to tell stories. And then the great irony, I think, is, at least for me, you know, the more you write, the less you get to read, because I won't read someone else's work while I'm writing, because I don't want their voice in my head. So my reading time becomes so much more limited and so much more precious to me that I'm very careful about what I read. When I started publishing my fiction, it was the year was 2003, 2004, and I met someone as I just finished writing my first book, and that someone was Radcliffe. And we were colleagues, we worked together, we started with the same publisher, and her work just blew me away. When I started, the first book of hers I read was a book called Above All Honor.
Mine too.
It was the start of, and it was the start of what would become what is now an 11-book series. You know, whether or not we'll get to, I assume, whether or not she's ever going to write another one in this series. But the thing about this series that drew me in was, first of all, the world in which the characters exist. You know, you've got a Secret Service agent who is assigned to protect the president's daughter, and they become, you know, romantically attracted to each other. And just the tension of that in and of itself makes for a great premise. You have to start with a great premise, and the great authors start with great premises. And so that was immediately intriguing to me. And then, you know, the situations present themselves as you go along. And that's sort of tailor-made for a series, because you know that it's a long-term relationship. Whether or not it works, it has to, by definition, be a long-term relationship, unless she gets fired from her job and, you know, goes off and does something else. And I'm not going to give too many spoilers throughout the series. I'm not going to do that to people. But what I will say was, at the time that Radcliffe started writing this series, what she was doing with political fiction was novel, pun intended, and unique, and set her apart from what anybody else was doing at the time. And of course, it appealed particularly to me because I was still working in that world, in the world of politics and government. And so for me, it was sort of like, you know, this little teeny fictional respite that I connected with, because I could connect with the world and I could connect with what the characters were going through. And I understood the kinds of scenarios that would present themselves in such a situation. Mm-hmm. And I could understand how the first daughter would feel about the protection and all of that. And I could understand the politics of the protection and the politics of the government and so on and so forth. And I had been, you know, vetted several times by the Secret Service myself, because I had interactions with presidents and things like that. And so I understood the way the Secret Service worked. And so it was a fascinating world that she created. And I was really swept along with it and with the series. And I would wait for the next book in the series to come out. And I'm like, okay, so what's coming next? When is it? You know, you get addicted to it because it's so fascinating, and you become part of these characters' world, and they become part of your world in a sense. And you come to care about them. I mean, you really find yourself sympathizing and empathizing with the characters in a way that makes it personal. You know, it's not just reading a book, it's a personal experience. And, you know, as the series goes on, of course, you introduce more and more characters to that world, and the world becomes fuller, and the characters have time to grow throughout the course of a series. And that's the thing about a series, is you have to leave your characters room and time to grow. You know, they can't stay stuck where they were in the first book. And you can't stay stuck as a writer where you were in the first book. Because if you do, you'll lose your audience. It will lose its appeal. You know, you're just repeating yourself, essentially. And so the beautiful thing about a series like the Honor series is the character arcs grow. You can see Radcliffe growing as a writer from the very first book she wrote until you see the series progress along. You can, in terms just of technique and style, you can see a change. It's subtle, which it needs to be because it's a series. It has to be consistent in some ways. But you can see the progress, and you can see that she is growing as the characters are growing and as their world is expanding. Which keeps you reading too, to me. I mean, it makes it more interesting. It makes it more intriguing, if you will. And I mean, there's endless numbers of plots that you can come up with that involve this kind of scenario. I mean, you could go on forever. I don't think she intends to go on forever with that series. But if she did, she could.
No.
You know? I mean, it's time sensitive in that you've got 8 years at the most. You know, a president can only serve 2 terms consecutively. So presumably, you know, if he gets reelected, if her father, Andrew Powell, gets reelected, that's, you know, that is what it is. And you've got 4 more years to finish telling your stories. Either that or you have to take the characters out of the environment in which you've placed them, which you can do. But that, you know, that can be a little dicey with your readers. It depends. Mm-hmm. Haven't tried it, so I don't know.
We don't know if Andrew Powell gets reelected, because that's kind of where things are left with the latest book.
If he gets reelected, so, you know, I mean, you would like to hope he would, wouldn't you?
Let it be a better world than the one we're in.
Exactly. Exactly. No kidding.
Thank you for being an awesome listener and supporting Tilt, the channel that brings you all the podcasts you want to hear. You're listening to Tilt. Find more podcasts on thelesbiantalkshow.com.
So before we go further, just in case we end up talking about something that makes it sound like anchored in the time that we're doing this, we are recording this near the end of May. So this episode is likely going up in August. Who knows what's going to happen at that point? We've got coronavirus. We have murder bees. No, murder hornets. I don't know. Godzilla might turn out to be real. We're not sure yet what 2020 has to hold.
I was thinking Sasquatch is coming. You know?
And his family. So you kind of like hinted toward this earlier. How real do you think too real is? Like, I know as a romance reader, and I mean, it's going to be different in different genres, but like personally, I don't want to read a bunch of coronavirus romances, if I'm honest.
I don't think we're ready for it. You know, and it's interesting, and I will talk about it both in context of 46, because it's what I'm working on right now, which is difficult to write something present day when present day shifts by the hour, as you just said. Mm-hmm. And it also takes place in the Honor series, as you know, around 9/11. And I want to talk some about that, because I was in New York at the time, and I had a lot of friends in the towers, and I was, you know, working closely with government at the time. One of my former offices was in the World Trade Center. This was really personal to me. And I grew up just outside New York City. So this is my home. They attacked my home. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk about the Honor series, those books that deal with that, and specifically in answer to your question. So for me right now, it is too early to talk about things like COVID. We're not ready to talk about things like COVID. And I don't know when we will be ready to talk about it. You know, at the front of the broadcast, we talked about the idea of chronicling our history. And I'm a great believer that we need to do that. The question is when we do that. And I think that's a very sensitive issue. I mean, if I wrote a book about coronavirus right now, nobody would read it. I promise you, nobody will read it. Well, maybe my wife might read it. That's maybe. About it. Maybe. You know, it's not nonfiction, so maybe not. But here's the thing. We will talk about it when we have some perspective with which to talk about it. Right now, I think that readers are not ready. And as an author, honestly, as emotional as it would be, I'm not ready to talk about it yet. We're not done with it, first of all. And second of all, even when we are, I think that we were going to take some time to find peace and perspective. And so I started writing 46 before the pandemic hit. And then it came along and I had to make a very clear decision for several reasons. First of all, because the book starts on election night 2020. It starts November 3rd, 2020. That's months from now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. My crystal ball is not working that well. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, are we going to be still social distancing at that point? Are we going to be, will we have found a vaccine? I seriously doubt that we will have a vaccine by that point. Are we going to be going out in large groups? Aren't we? You know, the very first scene opens in Central Park on election night, and she's addressing a crowd of 300,000 people. And I had to think about it. And I thought, what would my readers want? What's realistic? And what gives hope? What's hopeful in that? And I think right now as a writer, we're all, and as my colleagues too, Radcliffe and everybody else, I mean, I think we're all trying to instill some hope and some sense of normalcy, whatever that looks like. And I don't know what it looks like yet, but I really hope that it involves an in-person celebration of that kind where we can all stand in Central Park and celebrate the idea of the end of divisiveness and of being united again. So I made a conscious decision there not to include COVID. There's no mention of it in the book, none at all. I don't even mention the orange one because I can't bring myself to do it. You know, I say her predecessor, and if you don't know who that is, well, there you go. It's 46. He's 45. Do the math. But I think that we as authors are very careful about the choices we make, and particularly in romance. In romance, it's a little different. Political fiction, if it's pure political fiction, is one thing. It can be more realistic. It can be edgier, I think. But you're dealing with romance, and in romance, everybody is looking to escape just a little bit and find a happily ever after. And that doesn't necessarily occur for you as a reader, I think, if you're right in the middle of it. It's hard to look past that. And so I want to show you a world that's past that. And in terms of the honor series, what Radcliffe did with 9/11, she waited a few years before she wrote it, before she wrote that story in the fourth book in the series that specifically dealt with 9/11, and then the fifth book in the series, Honor Reclaimed, that dealt with the aftermath of 9/11. She waited, I think, 2 or 3 years to tell that story. And I remember at the time talking to her about it, and you know, she wasn't quite sure if even that was too soon. Do you remember there was a movie that came out, maybe it was called United Flight 93, I think, or something like that, that came out shortly after 9/11, like about within a year after 9/11, and it was all about 9/11. And the movie, which was a huge blockbuster that they invested a lot of money in, flopped at the box office. And it flopped at the box office because it was too soon. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see it. You know, people weren't ready to see it. And so there's a fine line there. And let me say that when I just reread, you know, those first 5 books in the series for the Honor series. Mm-hmm. And as I reread the book that specifically contains 9/11, mm-hmm. I had a hard time even today, all these years later, 19 years later, right? Was it 19 years? Yeah, my math is horrible, but that was 19 years ago. Jeez. Hard to believe, because it's like remembering where you were. You're not old enough, but I am. It's like remembering where you were when Kennedy was shot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it will be in the future for us remembering when COVID hit, because we're all going to remember this. You know, this is a defining moment in our lives, yeah, for sure. 9/11 was one of those defining moments in all of our lives. Everybody who was of an age remembers where you were and how it felt. It's like a visceral reaction in your body to it. So even 19 years later, reading the recap of the days and times and what happened really got me. I mean, I had to put the book down and come back to it again, because I, again, still had that my body was still reacting to that day. And I think that it speaks to how difficult it is to write political fiction real time, or anything that has a difficult subject matter real time while it's happening. It's very difficult to do. It's necessary to chronicle it at some point. The question is at what point you do it and how you do it. She handled it very sensitively. She did a good job with it. And she did, you could tell, a lot of research around the actual dates and times and players and how they, you know, how the terrorists got to be where they were and so forth. And she created a believable tie-in, which was really nice. But it, you know, I imagine that at the time she wrote it, and I remember I read it when it came out. I remember being triggered by it. I remember being triggered by it now, even now, only less so. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't mean you don't write it, because I think there's also, you have to take a chance. You have to be honest. in your fiction, especially if you're writing something that has a political backdrop, there is always the danger, mm-hmm. you know, of running into an audience that isn't ready to hear what you have to say. And maybe down the road they are, and maybe they're not. And I mean, you have to ask her how that book sold in relation to the others in the series yeah. at the time. It's hard to say. You take chances sometimes as an author. And sometimes they look like brave and bold chances, and sometimes you look at it and you think, oh my God, why did I do that? You know, maybe that wasn't such a great idea. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to take the chances as they present themselves, because that's part of our job. And particularly with political fiction, it's part of our job to tell the truth. It's part of our job to chronicle the times in which we live, because it creates the backdrop for our own lives.
So, what ultimately led you to write 46?
I started off, you know, my background, as I said, is politics and government and journalism. And I started off thinking, what in the world would it take to come back from this horrible, dark, deep hole we're in of divisiveness, of polarization, of a place where we think there, you know, there's fake news everywhere, where we're calling mainstream news outlets fake news. There are so many things about our last 3 years here, you know, from the time of inauguration in January 2017 until now, that are difficult and hard for us. And I wanted, you know, a lot of people come to me because they know that I have background and they know, you know, where I stand, and they've asked me to give them something of hope, something that gives them something that they can hold on to and look toward the horizon. And so I started thinking, with all of my professional background, how in the world do you solve this? How in the world, if I was advising the president today, as I've advised politicians in the past, what would my message be? How do we fix this? Mm-hmm. And then I started writing it. You know, I started saying, this is where we go. This is how we move our way forward. This is how we get our world back. This is how we get the United States back. This is how we recreate global community. This is how we remind people that we are more alike than we are, you know, unlike or whatever. Yeah, different. That's it. It's a big word. It's a very big word. Yes, you know, we're more alike than we are different. We are as one. And nothing has shown us that more than this pandemic, by the way, which doesn't discriminate mm-hmm. in any way across boundaries of countries and things like that. You know, it doesn't care whether you're rich or poor or white, black, brown, or anything in between, trans or gay or lesbian or straight. It doesn't care whether you're a Jew or whether you're a Catholic or a Protestant. It doesn't care, which should send us all the message about how much alike we are. We're all in this together. So I started before the pandemic to write 46 with a notion to unify us, with a notion to reestablish hope and to show a path forward and to send positive energy out into the universe and to my readers to say, don't worry, we can get back from here. There's a way. There's someone who can unite us. And this is the beacon of hope. Emma McMaster is the 46th president of the United States. I'm sorry, Pete Buttigieg, but it's going to be a lesbian, not a gay guy. I wanted to chart a path forward that would shine light and give hope and give readers something in the middle of all this garbage to look forward to, mm-hmm. you know, a world, a better world, a better place. And so that's where I started. And it's another reason why I couldn't include COVID in it. You know, it's not in sync with the message I'm trying to send. Yeah. So there you go.
What's it all about?
46.
Yeah. Do you have a blurb for us? You want to tell people what it's about?
Sure. 46 is Emma McMaster's, the next president of the United States, and her mission is to unify the country. Her slogan is "United We Stand," "E Pluribus Unum," which you'll see on every U.S. coin, and you see it on the United States, the President of the United States seal. It means out of many one. And so her fans start to chant back to her, E pluribus Emma, you know, which is great. You know, it's wonderful. But her mission is to restore faith in media, restore faith in the government, to reestablish our global ties, to show the world that there's a better way to do this. I show you a piece of her State of the Union. It was really kind of surreal. I was writing her State of the Union address, a piece of it. You don't see the whole thing. But I was writing her State of the Union address on the night that the orange one gave his State of the Union address. And I was watching him and writing my own and going, oh, this is so much better. This is so much more what a president should say.
Mm-hmm.
And her love interest in this is a 4-star general named Palmer Estes. Palmer has a very interesting past. She is a 2-time Purple Heart recipient. And in Desert Storm, she was Captain Estes, and she was a helicopter pilot, shot down during Desert Storm and injured. But she is this very enigmatic, very closely guarded, really principled person. She's about to retire from the military, and she is the top advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the White House. And so, you know, this is how she ends up interacting with Emma. And so the story is both very personal for Emma and for Palmer, and their romance is a very personal thing. And it's also a very principled book about the next president and how we move forward as a country and as a world, and who we want to be when we grow up. Hopefully we're growing up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn, where can people find you online if they want to connect with you?
You can find me at my website, www.lynnames, LynnAmes.com. You can find me on Facebook, author Lynn Ames, I think, there. Twitter, at Lynn Ames. Instagram, author Lynn Ames, and YouTube. I have no idea how you find me there, but you can.
Just do a search for the name Lynn Ames.
Do a search. It's out there somewhere. I love to interact with people. I love to connect with people. And, you know, it's all about community right now, isn't it? It's all about building a better world. It's all about finding a better way. And if something I can do, you know, starts us in that direction, then all the better.
That is all for this episode. Thank you so much for joining me.
It is my great pleasure. Thank you, Tara, for having me.
I'm Tara, and you've been listening to Les Do Books. You can email me at tara@thelesbianreview.com with your questions or comments. If you're an author who's interested in joining me on the show to talk about the lesfic you love or the trends that have you interested, please let me know. If you've enjoyed this episode, please check out the show notes where you'll find a Patreon link for Tilt, or visit patreon.com/thelesbiantalkshow. Our patrons get exclusive content like bonus podcasts that no one else gets access to. To find this and many other great shows, all you need to do is search for Tilt, spelled T-L-T, on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Spotify.